Johnny Paycheck, he's gone now. I believe he died. Yeah, he was a country western singer, hit the top of the charts, but he also went to prison for a while. He wrote a lot of songs in prison, performed a lot in prison. I'm not sure what his so-called alleged crime was. He shot somebody, I know. I read that someplace, but anyhow. Yeah, he's the only hell that mama ever raised here in the bunker. We're in the bunker. Hello out there in sheepland. Terrible Tommy here. Yeah, our address is P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you get your donations in for the radio show. And then get up there on that resist.com and get smart. Yeah, remember that TV show? I never liked that Maxwell Smart, that little Jew. Talked into his shoe all the time. He's got to be a crazy bastard. Yeah. Okay, let's see what we're going to do for the show today. Oh, there was something I wanted to play for you about the AIPAC, you know, the big old Jew outfit. Well, they've got... They got Trump invited to that big old meeting, but they're having problems because they don't want to. They keep talking about it, and they want to do something about it, and they want to walk out when he comes in. And let me see if I can find that article.
A prior version of this piece, posted on this site earlier this afternoon, channeled what I think is a rage many of us share and called on the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee to disinvite Donald Trump from speaking at its annual conference on Monday night. That, sadly, is not a possibility, as a tax-exempt non-profit organization bound by Section 501(c)(3) 3 of the United States Tax Code, APAC must provide equal opportunity to all political candidates to participate in its events. The group extended the mandatory invitation, and Trump said yes. There's nothing more APAC can do. But that doesn't mean that Trump's speech at a major American Jewish gathering should pass quietly. Donald Trump, this can't be said loudly, clearly, or often enough, is appealing to sheer and unmasked bigotry to fuel his incendiary political campaign. You can approve of his policies, if you can discern what they actually are. You can find his narcissism funny, even charming. You can even turn your head away from the assaults on journalists, if not sanctioned by his campaign then at least supported by it. But the repeated and vile denigration of immigrants, Muslims, and others for no purpose save for the inflammation of electoral nervous systems is more than we ought to tolerate. Whatever else he may do to our political landscape, Trump also presents us, particularly us American Jews, with a golden opportunity. For decades, we've allowed our core ethical principles to ossify into talking points. We spoke of Tikkun Olam, a principle so ephemeral and universal it equally applies to Jews, Zoroastrians, and fans of the Detroit Tigers, offering little by way of real theological guidance. When we took up real causes, Israel, say, or the economy, or racial justice, we often chose to do it from within the well-dug trenches of party lines or ideological divides. Trump gives us a chance to come together over a very basic principle and say that as Jews, secular and religious, Democrats and Republicans, poets and podiatrists, we feel compelled by the very tenets of our faith to reject a man who lacks any respect for the very principles of pluralism that have made this country such a welcoming home for Jews and have allowed us to thrive here for more than two centuries. There's not much we can do, sadly, to curb Trump's rise. Democracies let voters make their own choices, even if these choices are ruinous for them and for the nation. But there's one symbolic action we can, and must, take. When Trump swaggers onto the podium Monday night, let us leave. Not one or two but all of us, not a trickle but a torrent. Let him speak to an empty room, and let the cable news channels carrying the latest Trump spectacle marvel that one group of Americans not particularly large, not particularly influential had the courage to say enough to this shameful circus of lies and violence, turn its back, literally, to this dangerous demagogue, and walk out. This gesture may mean nothing. But it may inspire other Americans, liberal or conservative or anything in between, and it will remind us all that somewhere, obscured by talk of delegates and endorsements and big walls and short fingers and other trivialities, the better angels of our nature, to borrow a phrase from a real Republican, quietly stand, waiting for us to turn to them once again and, once again, make America great.
Thank you, She-Wolf. Well, boys and girls, I'd like to be at that meeting. I'd like to put that yarmulke I stole from someplace on and get into that meeting. I'm not sure where it's going to be, probably Washington, D.C. or New York City. But hopefully somebody gets inside, because this is going to be like a barrel of monkeys, I think. I think that they're overestimating themselves about Trump. I feel sure there are plenty of Jews in there that like him. So anyhow, here you got the Jews on one side, APAC, very powerful pro-Israel lobby, saying that they're going to walk out, man. They don't like this guy. Well, methinks thou protest too much. But it's going to be interesting to see, and I hope they do let some press in there so they can take pictures of this big walkout. There might be, there might not be. So anyhow, there may be a Jew who, or not a Jew who. We'll see. Monday night, baby. Well, I see that Meir Dagan, former head of the Mossad, dies at 71. Nicknamed Superman by his Arab opponents, Dagan was a fierce and smart warrior who was unafraid to speak his mind. Wow. It's interesting that the modern Mossad supported the peaceful situation with Iran while the Netanyahu was all for bombing them. So the Mossad is... had a falling out on some things with the premier of Israel, which is not too common. Well, it's Friday, boys, and I think it's time for you all you ignorant white people out there, white people, to hear about white supremacy and how it affects the Negro. So I brought some Negroes on here to tell you about it. So you sit back and you'll see how it's just skin. It's just skin, nothing else. And so here we go. Now let me set you up for this. This is a black radio show, and they got a white colored rabbi, and the Negroes are calling in, and the rabbi is telling them what for and guiding the conversation.
5, 6, 7, 8 years, you know, with you, Armstrong, and, you know, it's an eye-opening experience to listen to our audience week in, week out, every Monday, every Thursday, to listen to the real experience. And we're not listening to people screaming and yelling and carrying on and, you know, having a big fit out on the street and doing all the rest of it. We're listening to reasoned people who are sharing with us their experience, strength, and hope. Their experiences in the real world, and if their experiences are to be believed, these things really exist. So, you know, we need to solve them because they're unacceptable in our America. That's my view. That's the reason that I'm willing to talk about it. It's unacceptable to me as an American in my America that people are treated differently because of the color of their skin. It's the most absurd thing I've ever heard in my life. Yashi in Florida.
It's Yashi. Anyway, Yashi. Mr. Armstrong, good evening.
Good evening. Yashi.
Yes, sir. I want to address 2 points. Last week I called you, and what happened, I may have not articulated myself properly, but you were very upset with my call. But anyway, I apologize for that. I want to say something. I'm looking at this on a different perspective, because white people will talk to me because I have an accent about black people in America as if they're talking to another white person. And they'll say derogatory stuff. And I say, wait a minute. If you don't hear me speak, you would say the same thing about me. So sometimes I have to correct them and say, look, I'm the same person as that same black person you're talking about. The only difference is I came to this country, I live here more than half my life, but I came to this country with a culture. I don't have some of the inferiority complex that I see our people has, in the sense that when a child goes to the doctor, my doctors were black. When my parents, they go to a lawyer's office, they were black. All my teachers were black. And so I look at it and the perspective like you have, but with a caveat. I understand the racism because it happens to me every day, and I see it happens to people almost every day institutionally. Now, individually, we may be doing okay, but as an institution, as a people, the institutions, they hold us back so much. So it's very visible to me. And now, what the rabbi has said, for me, it does not affect me in the same way, because I, like him, look at it as a spiritual sense, since I live my life as an Hebrew Israelite. So, in the sense, I look at it as a spiritual thing, and yes, to the rabbi, racism does exist. If it was something we did to cause this to happen to us, then the punishment would be that racism. So it does exist. So remember, slavery happened was the worst thing in the world that could ever happen to any group of people. It's, you can't compare anything in the world to it. Because it's the most devastating thing that ever happened to a people. And so, yes, do you think something like that, that devastated a people to the point where they hate themselves, doesn't have something to do with a divine presence behind it? Oh, you would be, if you're a spiritual person, you'd be saying, it has to be. But if you're not a spiritual person, then you'll say, well, it doesn't exist. It's a social construct. Yes, it is a social construct in the real sense. But in a spiritual sense, no, it's a divine construct. Because the rabbi was right in certain sense. And so my perspective of it, it does not affect me personally. In my day-to-day business, because I'm looking at it that way in a spiritual sense, but I can see the natural sense in my everyday dealing business. It does rear its ugly head.
Well, listen, thank you.
I have came with a set of tools to deal with it as an individually, but collectively as a people, it's devastating to us.
Well, thank you for calling and sharing your thoughts with us. Let's go to Don in California. Hello, Don.
Hey, what's up, Armstrong?
You, brother.
Hey, Don. Hey, man, you know, I tell you, man, and I think one of your callers that called earlier that talked about just acknowledging, not succumbing to racism or whatever name you want to give it. You know, you can't work on something sometimes if you don't give it a name. And because people of color and gays and Asians and other races have probably experienced certain things in this lifetime, I think racism probably is easier to explain maybe what a person that had gone through similar experiences can maybe come up with. And, you know, when you study history and you hear about the shooting of young black men, you tend to say, man, something is going on. You know, you may not want to call it racism, but if it's happening on a large scale to the same people all the time, you know, I mean, you tend to be persuaded that something is going on. And, you know, you were open about yourself. You grew up and you may have, you know, not experienced it like maybe I have. I mean, I'm 57 years old, and as I look back over my childhood, because of where I was raised, I tended to experience it more as opposed, I grew up in the projects. We were poor. We were on welfare. And so, you know, things that may have happened to me and my family may not, if you didn't grow up in the projects, you know, you probably wouldn't see it the way I see it. We walk away with two different opinions because we've had two different experiences. And so, you know, it's just hard for me to get away. Now, agreeing with the other caller, you have to, if you do want to call it that, then I agree with the other caller. You look at it as though this is still not going to stop me. I'm still going to be successful, like Dr. Ben Carson. This is not going to be what I wake up and think about every morning, you see. And my last point is this. I had a different opinion about Dr. Ben Carson when I read Gifted Hands and when I read Think Big and I watched the PBS stuff about him as a brilliant neurosurgeon. Now, as a politician, I have now created a big question mark in my mind about Dr. Ben Carson because somehow the skill set and the brilliance that he had as a and still have as a neurosurgeon, I don't know if you could transfer it over. You know, he's a believer in the area that he went into. You know, he was just so, to me, he's so far ahead in his thinking. Now, did I agree with all of his opinions and how he viewed certain things? No, I didn't. But I'd just like to remember him as the neurosurgeon more than I want to remember him as a politician.
Well, look, thank you. As all callers, very interesting, very insightful, but also very thoughtful. Let's go to Michael in Georgia. Hello, Michael.
Good afternoon, my brother. How are you doing today?
Just fine.
Well, I think the thing that we're reading into racism does not exist. We make it exist because things happen and occur in our lives that are caused by people that don't look like us, and we call it racism. But when that same thing is done to us by us, we don't call it racism. So my thought is racism does not exist. Individualism exists. That's what it is. It's not racism. It's how we think as individuals. And during the 60s and the 70s, we were on our way to be great in this country. And what happened was a system was put in place.
Fire! Fire! Somebody torched the building!
Great country that we call America is imploding on itself. And until we, as the Christ-like people, I don't want to say spiritual or religious people, but those people who have that Christ mind, stand up and say, no, this is wrong, not only for ourselves, but for everyone, it's going to continue to happen. We can put a stop to this. We, the melanated people, can put a stop to this. But first of all, we must change our educational system, because not only are our children being deprived of the truth, but so are theirs.
Hear, hear. Thank you for sharing that.
So until we start telling the truth, Armstrong, we're going to have a problem.
Who's there? By the way, who's theirs? You keep referring to theirs. Is that me? Because I'm white. Is that the me people? Oh, okay. Armstrong, is that me?
David,
are you referring to me?
I
was just asking you.
I would dare not speak for him.
Oh.
Would not dare. That's what it will there.
Well, thank you, She-Wolf, for suffering through that, and I hope everybody out there now understands what racism is and how it's not. There is no such thing, but there is something there and could be, and I think so, and... Armstrong Williams got a radio show on Sirius Radio, and they get pretty serious. Well, speaking of the black man, there's a black man got charged with a federal hate crime. This is shocked. I am totally shocked. A Georgia black man could face federal hate crime charges for dousing a gay couple. That's a homosexual couple with boiling water. Yeah. He admitted pouring boiling hot water on a gay couple while they slept. Wow, man. Do you think he'll get a hate crime, federal hate crime charge? I don't. I think he'll just get a regular assault charge. Well, the homosexual couple are recovering. The victims say they were sound asleep when they were attacked. The pain doesn't let you sleep, Marquez Talbert, 21, said. It's just like it's excruciating 24 hours a day and doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't dial down anything, it's just there. I don't know whether these victims were black or not. Tolbert has second and third degree burns on his back, neck, and arms. According to Tolbert, him and his boyfriend, Anthony Gooden, were severely burned last month when Gooden's mother's boyfriend walked in on them sleeping at the Gooden's apartment and poured water all over them, hot water. Tolbert spent 10 days in the Grady Memorial Hospital and underwent surgery that took skin from his thigh to replace the skin on his back. Gooden was released from the hospital on Friday. Well, let's see here. Martin Blackwell remains in Fulton County Jail. The 48-year-old has been charged with two counts of aggravated battery. That's what he'll get off with. No federal hate crimes. No. It don't work that way, white boys. Well, up in San Jose, more than 50 black San Jose State University students rallied Thursday against the sentencing of three former students who assaulted their roommate in 2013 and claimed that the college hasn't addressed the racism on the campus. It's everywhere. It's everywhere. A diverse group of students from various campuses organizations chanted, "Black Lives Matter! Black Lives Matter!" while they stood outside the Tower Hall as the bell struck noon. Whoa. Well, these guys got off. Evidently, they weren't guilty. Oh, yes, they were white. They got to be guilty. And they didn't get a very big sentence. They should have gotten life in the electric chair. Well, here's another hate crime alert. Let's see what they got to say.
In Decatur, a family is accusing their neighbor of a hate crime. 43-year-old Charles Jeanette was arrested on Tuesday after his neighbors across the street say he yelled racist terms at them several times and hung up a Confederate flag on his front porch. The neighbors say they were holding a prayer meeting on their porch during Jeanette's display. Jeanette faces one count of a hate crime and is out on $15,000.
Don't forget our new hotline, or not so new, but a hotline. You can leave a message for me. I check it every day. That's 559-670-1473. If you got a question for me, put it on there and I'll get back to you. Let's see how you too can become a CIA monster, baby.
You went from a clean upbringing into a world of dirty tricks in your mature life.
Yeah. But the key thing is that as you get recruited into the CIA, it never occurs to you that if you're as naive as I was, and I think most of the young men that come into the CIA are, it never occurs to you that you're getting into a world of dirty tricks. The come-on that they have, the things they use to sell, is that you're finally getting into the elite inner circles of the United States government. All your life you've been going through the amateurs and the prelims and the prep schools, in effect, and finally this is it. This is where the people are real pros, the frontline warriors saving the nation from communism.
The Phoenix program was created by the CIA, and its purpose was to kill and terrorize. In Vietnam, I was forced to do business with a police chief who was a sadistic mutilator of prisoners. He liked to carve them up and throw the remains in the river. And he was completely paid and propped up by the CIA. His whole career depended on, one, controlling that operation so that the CIA needed him, and two, the CIA propping him up and funding him. And he did his knife work in a CIA safe house. He called it the Pink House. I reported this to the chief of station, and he said, well, you know, it's a rough world, and sometimes you have to do business with people that really aren't your first choice of the kind of people you want to associate with, so don't make a wave. And so I went back, you know, what do? Resign my post? Yeah, you know, that's your last vote, though. You resign and you're out. And I wasn't ready to give up my career yet. I terminated the safe house. I told case officers that I don't want to hear about it. If this guy has a compulsion to do this sort of thing anymore, I don't want to hear about it.
How does the CIA go about recruiting its future candidates for officers and agents?
Have any of y'all been approached here? Has recruiters come through here and talk to you?
No.
You know, somebody in this room might be sweating right now because he's been told, you know, if they ask you, don't say anything.
I hear that they do use professors to keep eyes out in their classes for particular students who might be interested in that sort of work. But I wonder how, were you approached here at the university, or were you approached sometime later in your career?
At the university, a CIA recruiter came through. I went and talked to them. He did not write my name down. And in 64, early 64, I got a letter in the mail saying, would I mind if the CIA did a security check? And I wrote back saying, I was restless, and I wrote back saying I'd be delighted if it was for possible employment. With my background, there were fields where I would be unique. From the Congo, I went to the University of Texas and enrolled in the ROTC program. I graduated in 1959 and took a commission in the Marine Corps. I didn't see my future as a career officer, so when my term was up, I accepted an offer as a junior executive at the Gates Rubber Company and went with my family to Colorado.
We were very young and idealistic, with three children when the CIA first approached us. We were in the Marine Corps for 3 years and did not want to go the military route, although there was a very promising career there. When you think about his job being a career or national security, I think that at the time the emphasis was career. I think that most of what he did was for the next fitness report, so to speak. I think that people generate activity that is unnecessary overseas. In order to have some activity on their fitness report, and they really don't get promoted within the CIA unless they have so many recruitments, let's say in a tour of duty, or so many operations or ops, as they call them.
The way the CIA works, you're promoted on the basis of your fitness report, which you get every few months or at the end of every assignment, at least once a year, usually more often. And this evaluates your performance both with a letter grade and also a written narrative. That and the assignments you get will develop your career.
I said, why don't you just go in there and tell them that this is immoral and this is something you can't do? And he said, well, they don't want, you're not going to get anywhere in your career if you say no to assignments. And by that time, though, he was hooked by the CIA, and the assignments were sexy assignments and interesting assignments.
In one post, we put 7 bugs in a foreign embassy. It was quite dramatic and very exciting. And we had officers and support officers and technicians flying all over Africa on this thing. And we got them in. Of the 7 bugs that we installed clean, we never got caught, 5 of them never came up on the air. They were totally defective. The 6th one would transmit, but the switch, the activator to shut off the thing when no one was speaking, was defective, so it burned out its batteries in the course of about 6 weeks' time and went off the air. And one of them functioned properly. And that one, although it was in an ambassador's office of a country that was very much a target of intelligence activities, that one never produced a single disseminable report. I felt like I was really making time professionally. I was a very young officer when I met my first president. We had a mutual interest. There were things I could do for him, and there were things he could do for us, at least in terms of making me feel secure in his country. If I was meeting him and he appreciated what I was doing for him, it wasn't likely that he was going to throw me out if I made a mistake or got caught. And it was pretty heady stuff for a very young officer. And it meant that I was getting recognition back at headquarters, obviously. You know, there's young Stockwell who's meeting President X, and we better keep our eye on Stockwell. He looks good.
My function at home when agents would come to the home would be to turn on the record player and be sure that the curtains were closed and that there was enough security in my own home that the person wouldn't, you know, be compromised by having come to our home. I didn't really, at that time, I didn't realize that we would be putting these people in danger, and that some would be put in jail, and that some would be dead.
A lot of other things happen in the world that's sort of like somebody pushing a rock off the cliff, and the rock hits somebody, and then, you know, they step back and say, I didn't kill them, the rock killed them. And this is sort of what happened in Ghana. The agency, to my knowledge, did not write a paper saying, let's overthrow Nkrumah. The chief of station there was a very aggressive man, and he became aware of the fact that there was the possibility of a coup developing, and he knew the players, people who in the army who were unhappy, and he began to report and to ask for encouragement, to encourage these men. And as I understand it, he was not given a formal permission to attempt to overthrow Nkrumah, but he was given permission to monitor the developments of any coup. And this gave him an excuse to meet these officers often, daily, several times a day, and to give them money, and in effect to give them encouragement. A soft file is a file that doesn't have an official name on it or cryptonym on it, and is not registered into the agency's IBM system, the system of 201 numbers, so that it can't be traced. If you come to the agency demanding to see your file, and if they have a soft file on you instead of a 201, you'll never get it. They may have a manila folder in there with reams of documents about you, and you'll never get access to it.
There were times when I said, well, let's just get out of the CIA. You know, Bob, really you're making a decision, which is, it's getting to the point where it's going to be the CIA or it's going to be our marriage. And he chose the CIA.
Well, that footage was a little older, but I can assure you that it's probably even worse now, especially after 9/11, the way things went and all the torture and everything. But it's been going on for decades. And they recruit all over the place. They recruit in the media, cameramen, reporters, all that kind of stuff. You name it. That's why when you do an interview, many times you consider yourself being interrogated. Yep. Well, I see Berlin, from Berlin, that Germany has banned the National Socialist Group White Wolves Terror Crew, WWT. Their first mistake was adopting a name like that, or a name period, and advertising themselves. Following raids on 15 properties across the country, as worries grow about the rise of the right-wing sentiment after the influx of more than a million migrants last year, attacks on refugee shelters are increasing, with more than 200 on migrant hostels this year. And the right-wing sympathizers responsible for almost all of them, the police say. Interior Minister Thomas D. Meyerzier said that there was no place in Germany for groups like the WWT. Well, I would suggest there's no place in Germany for massive numbers of people from the Middle East, and that the WWT, made up of white people, have many more rights in Germany as those migrants do. So he can go screw himself. Which his ministry says advocates the creation of a dictatorship based on Nazism. Well, they've got a pretty much a dictatorship now, isn't it? What's she okayed all the migrants to come out of North Africa and come into Europe? Not only is she the dictator of Germany, she's the dictator of Europe. The WWT acts openly and aggressively against our state and our society, against invaders and people who think differently, he said. Well, you do the same thing. The state always does the same thing. It spreads xenophobic and inhuman ideology. I don't think you can prove that. It brings right-wing extremist incitement into the street and is not scared of committing violence. Well, your government's not afraid of that either. Hamburg's intelligence agency said that in a report last year that WWT was originally a fan club of a right-wing radical skinhead band, that some of the members had been seen shouting Sieg Heil, oh my God, they said Sieg Heil, and giving the Nazi salute. Both are banned in Germany. Any place where they ban free speech and all that kind of stuff is due to be dealt with. Hamburg's intelligence agency said in a report last year that the WWT was originally... Oh, they already said that. Well, these guys are going to have to learn. They're going to have to be lone wolf or leaderless resistance and no uniforms, none of that stuff. No names, no WWT, none of that, you know. Or you're always going to go down the tube. Because you're a long way from having the support of the general population, and you got to be careful, and I doubt whether you can trust it anyhow. Even if they all came out and said, you're wonderful. Well, I see over in Hanover, Germany, the court jails neo-Nazi arsonists. Three arsonists convicted of firebombing a hostel for the asylum seekers or invaders have been jailed for up to 8 years. The Hanover's court presiding judge rejected denial, saying that the motive was neo-Nazi racism akin to Hitler. You got to be more sneaky, boys and girls. You're not near sneaky enough. And you got to judge what you're doing there, you know. One little hostel, that's not going to change things in Germany. No. And then all of you go to prison for 8 years. That's not a very good trade-off, boys and girls. They're going to have better leadership and think things out a little better. At least you'll be treated better than you would be in an American prison, that's for sure. Well, I see an Oberlin College professor, Joy Kariga, gets big thumbs up from neo-Nazis, white supremacists. Some of the most notorious white supremacist websites have expressed support for Joy Kariga, the Oberlin College professor who has come under heavy criticism after her Facebook posts, which contain conspiracy theories that many consider to be anti-Semitic, were revealed in the Tower newspaper last week. Kariga shared her belief that Israel was behind the Charlie Hebdo terrorist attack and the rise of ISIS, and the Jewish banker Jacob Rothschild owns your news and media, your oil and your government. She also promoted a lecture by Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, who said that the Israeli Zionist Jews rigged explosives to destroy the World Trade Center. In response, the chair of the college's board of trustees calls her posts anti-Semitic and abhorrent and said that a review must be considered expeditiously. Well, I would have, if I was advising the gal, I'd have told her to keep her mouth shut because there's nothing you're going to say on your Facebook that's going to change anything. It's got to start coming unraveling a lot more. And there's no use you throwing your career away, and some of this stuff is questionable anyhow. The same college has no problem promoting white guilt, white genocide, and the concept of evil whitey now is upset because a black professor is posting anti-Semitic comments online. Wait a minute. A dues-paying member of the White Supremacist Web Forums, Stormfront, wrote on March 8th, quote, I guess she should have just stuck to evil whitey comments. Then her job wouldn't be in jeopardy. Well, I am amazed that she's posting the same stuff we do, and she wasn't fired on the spot. Another user responded that if Kariga wanted to make her case to fling bad news for the Jews, the bad part is we have allowed this situation to evolve to the point where the entire country is threatened by enemies, both foreign and domestic. The fight is here, not the Middle East. Well, I agree with that. I agree with that. Let's see, there's a little more to this story. The Anti-Defecation League has called Stormfront the oldest and largest white supremacist website on the Internet, which gives the ADL an excuse to exist and rake more money in. The Stormfront's going to get you. And described it as a meeting place for anti-Semites, neo-Nazis, and other white supremacists, including FBI agents, CIA agents, ATF agents, and all kinds of people. Yeah, you keep going to those websites like that, and you'll probably end up in the back of the jail. Kariga, once you know the program of the white race and white racial separatism, how much more do you need to know? I mean, you can go to our website and get a tremendous education on the books that we have up there, and so forth, without risking your life and freedom. Kariga also got support from a blog called WickedZionism.com, whose publisher asserts, "I oppose both anti-Semitism and Zionism." The publisher of Wicked Zionism claimed that Kariga was being slandered for speaking out about the Israeli involvement in 9/11. Well, of course he is. What do you expect him to do? What do you expect these idiots to do? You put your head in the lion's mouth and the lion's going to chomp down on you. Right wing will never, ever learn. That's why you shouldn't mess around with them, because they don't know tactics. They don't know sneaky. They don't know a whole lot of things they should have learned by now, after 50, 75 years at least. They always want to lead with their chin. Here's my chin, Jews. Here's my chin, Negroes. Here's my chin, all you other folks. Hit me. Hit me. Earlier this month, Kariga expressed gratitude for the support of Kevin Barrett, a contributor to the website Veterans Today, which the Southern Poverty Law Center described in 2013 as squarely in neo-Nazi territory. Barrett subsequently published two more defenses of Kariga. On March 5th, he asserted that it is a simple fact that virtually all wealthy, powerful Jews are pro-Zionist, and that many are fanatically dedicated to using their wealth and power to support the Zionist entity occupying and genociding Palestine, unquote. Gee, that's a shock. Boy, that's really news. 4 days later, he directly addressed the Tower, asserting that the self-appointed representatives of the American Jewish community, such as the Tower.org staff, which I've never heard of, ought to stop whining anti-Jewish bigotry and face the fact that Jewish community itself is infested by raging bigotry, Barrett went on. Well, of course. Even a lot of anti-Zionist Jews. The Zionists who blew up the World Trade Center and accused their enemies exemplify this phenomenon. Likewise with those who staged the Paris and San Bernardino massacres. Telling the truth is not bigotry, it's honesty. It's all Jewish. Everything in the world that goes bad is Jewish. And if you don't believe that, you must be a Nazi. Wait a minute. Is it the other way around? Barrett appeared earlier this week on Press TV, I figured that, an Iranian propaganda station, calling last week's U.S. District Court ruling, in which Iran was found liable for $10 billion in damages due to their ties to the 9/11 hijackers, bizarre and outrageous. Evidence has shown that Iran has regularly worked with al-Qaeda. The U.S. government recently declassified a 2007 letter from Osama bin Laden to an al-Qaeda associate, calling Iran the main artery for funds, personnel, and communication for his terror organization. Barrett is frequently cited on Stormfront. And thus goes the right wing again and again and again. Here's my chin. I'm from Star From. Hit me. Hit me. Go ahead and hit me. It's okay. Send me to prison. That's all right. I'll never learn. Earlier this month, an email was sent out to a large number of Oberlin students from a self-described truth seeker and Christian man with high morals accusing Zionist Jews of committing the 9/11 attacks. Oberlin Dean of Students, Eric Estes, denounced the emails as anti-Semitic and deeply offensive shortly afterwards. Don't you people in the right wing realize they don't give a shit how much of this stuff you put out about 9/11? They're not going to do anything about 9/11. They're not going to do a goddamn thing. And you can whine just like you whine about all the Jewish crimes back 100 years. They're never going to do anything about it until there's a total collapse of the system. And then if you got any balls, we might be able to change it. But I don't know. Sometimes I wonder the mentality we're dealing with. Oh, the media's got something to go on now because of PBS NewsHour. Took a picture of a Trump supporter working on her computer. Says she has Nazi tattoos. Well, I see it here, and all I see is a Celtic cross on her back of her hand. The rest of the tattoo on her arm has nothing to do with race. So she got a Celtic symbol, which you can see all over Europe. And they're making a big deal out of it, but when Bernie raises his arm with a clenched fist salute, which is the traditional communist Marxist salute, nobody says that. Have you seen any, has anybody said anything about Bernie's clenched fist salute? I haven't heard anybody mention it. I guess everybody's dead that lived back in the 70s, because back then, that was what all the extreme leftists and Marxists did whenever they did anything like that. They gave a clenched fist salute. So next time you see Bernie give that clenched fist salute, you'll know where it came from. And nobody jumping on his ass. He's a wonderful guy. So what? When you got thousands of volunteers working in your campaign, well, hell, they've all... A whole bunch of them got tattoos. And you're going to go through every one of them and make sure? The other side sure don't do that. The other side doesn't do. They don't give a shit. If you're warm, you're okay. It's interesting to see Ron Paul come out and attack Trump. Now, I'm not siding with Trump, but I'm sure not siding with Ron Paul either. I've never trusted those guys. They talk a pretty good line, but it never goes anywhere. Typical right wing conservative stuff. Oh yeah, he says some good things once in a while. Everybody says, "Oh, Ed, that's our man. He's going to save our ass." Forget it. None of them going to save your ass. Only you can save your ass. Well, Bernie Sanders says if elected, I'd ask Obama to withdraw the Jew Garland nomination to make his own SCOTUS pick, whatever the hell SCOTUS is. Well, Obama's in trouble again. Many liberals are expressing unhappiness that President Obama, his Supreme Court nominee, is a white male. They don't say a white male Jew. As the president tries to rally grassroots support for Judge Merrick Garland in the uphill battle to gain a confirmation hearing from Senate Republicans. Mr. Obama held a conference call Thursday on the Garland nomination with the progressive groups on whom he is counting to pressure the Senate to hold a vote on his nominee. He said the issue is about fairness and the government's integrity. Well, this morning on Black Radio, they had a gal on there, and they're all screaming and yelling, "We need a black woman on that Supreme Court. We want a black woman on that Supreme Court." To wit, I would say, well, toss out two or three of the Jews on the court and put yourself one black woman in there. Ha, ha, ha. The recent elections went as predicted. This was in Germany. A new right-wing party, Alternative for Germany, AfD, has emerged with force and will be in the national parliament in 2017. This development is unprecedented in German politics, at least since the 30s, since the end of the Second World War, and is widely viewed as a part of a general trend. Of course, what did you expect? The rise of populist and racial forces all over Europe. The European elections in 2004 rang the first warning bell. The euro crisis and social instability saw the beginning of a surge to the right. Since then, every national election has been a shift in the internal balance. Historical examples of civics and tolerance in the Nordic countries, such as Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, has changed direction. The Swedish Democrats, a party rooted in the neo-Nazi movement, has forced the country to change its popular policy on open-door refugees. Open-door invaders it is, you know. The Danish Popular Party last summer emerged as a second choice. In Finland, the True Finns became a third force in 2015 and are now in the governmental coalition. In 2011, the massacre of 78 Norwegians by the neo-Nazi Breivik heralded the end of the Nordic political identity. Since 2004, the right-wing parties just grew. Now they're in power in Hungary and Poland, and a few days ago, the pro-Nazi People's Party of Slovakia is firmly in parliament as the fourth force. And if elections are held today, the Freedom Party of Islamophobe Geert Wilders would get the first place in the Netherlands. In France in 2015, the parties had to join forces to block Marine Le Pen from winning the French regional elections. The weight of the UK Independence Party, the UKIP, has obliged Cameron to call for a referendum on Europe. In Austria, the right Freedom Party won 20.5% of the votes, and more recently, it came ahead either of the socialists or the Christian Democrats in some state elections, entered in a socialist-led government in Burgenland, and gained more than 30% of the votes in Vienna. In Italy, the votes of the Five Stars movement added with those of the League of Matteo Salvini, it is almost 40% of the anti-Europe vote. Obviously, the arrival of more than a million invaders has given, caused by the United States State Department, of course, and the Pentagon, has given a boost to all xenophobic parties, and the alternatives for Germany's fast rise has been explained as a punishment to Merkel. Well, of course, she's a Manchurian candidate, you fool. It had to be. Nobody in their right mind as a leader would do that unless they're controlled by someone who really wants it. She opened the door for the invasion without any consolation, not even with France. She didn't talk to nobody. She just did it. She's being controlled by higher powers. But besides this obvious explanation, it would be time to consider why, since the crisis of 2009, in such a short time, a campaign against Europe and for a nationalist platform seems to be so successful. Even without the refugee invaders, the right-wing tide has been a clear and evident fact. Refugees have become just as an accelerator to what has happened everywhere, and why those right-wing parties attract a very variegated electorate, from workers to housewives, from pensioners to young students. In other words, the working class. And why suddenly the dream of European integration has lost popular support. Obviously, this would entail a complex and long analysis that we cannot afford here, but I would like to add an uncomfortable angle of reflection, probably not politically correct. The strict intransigence of the German government. Let's see here. Embodied by the Nein Fuhr Allen, no to everything, i.e. the Minister of Finance Wolfgang Schäuble, has contributed to the decline of European dream. Until the crisis of, well, it's contributing to somebody's dream right now. Anything that bad that happens, somebody wants it to happen. Until the crisis of 2009, there is no serious financial and social problems. Then the crisis came. What about Greece? And Europe is now barely back to the pre-crisis level. Italy, not yet. This means that during the 7 years of austerity imposed by Germany, with the epic fight on Cyprus and then Greece, and the splitting Europe with a north-south divide is the only way forward. It would be, of course, irresponsible to suggest that the south of Europe could have ignored rules and budgets, but to make the European Union a warden, visibly indifferent to the savage cuts in public expenses from welfare to hospitals to the emerging dramatic youth unemployment everywhere, was not certainly the best recipe to give an attractive image of the European institutions. Ah, I love chaos. I love chaos. And chaos is everywhere. It makes Tommy happy. Germany did not look a superpower passionate of its wealth, intensive insensitivity to others' problems, which went by its own way and with no interest in consultation or socialization. Well, I think that is pretty much a character of the Germans. It was easy during the 7 years of crisis to attract a large number of people who felt left out. Let me in. Ignored by the traditional political parties who did remember or imagine the good times of national sovereignty. Yeah. Tribalism and national sovereignty. They saw in foreign banks and corporations their enemy. In foreigners, those who were robbing their jobs. Of course they were. Remember the British campaign against the Polish plumber? Well, you bring people from another country and taking people's jobs, you got to expect to get it in the ass. And saw Brussels as a bunch of unelected bureaucrats who did want to intrude in their lives, which is true, totally true. And decide the shape of the tomatoes, Berlin did not do anything to correct that trend. It made a moral issue of the deficit of the debtor countries and blocked any attempt to socialize the excedent of its economy with others. Yeah, a bunch of bureaucrats decided what they wanted and tried to stuff it down the throats of the Europeans. Well, it may be time to consider the German intransigence has a responsibility in the surge of the right wing and nationalist tide with the message that they did not care about others. Oh, they're supposed to care about everybody else? Ain't gonna happen, boys and girls. Might is right. Intent only to keep their privileged situation. Well, who doesn't? European solidarity is over. Listen to me. One by one, its allies went into budget deficits like Austria, Finland, and the Netherlands without Berlin even noticing. Screw them. Octoliba. Austria was a taboo which could not be discussed, like one cannot or must not discuss moral or religious dogmas. No, one must get rid of moral and religious dogmas and go by the code of the evolution and Mother Nature. Seek how, Mother Nature. Now we got to get this weather change moving faster. We gotta have more stuff melting. It can be easily said that this is lamentation is from the side of the debtors, and that is usually what they do. Pass on responsibility to the creditors. Yeah, fuck you, I ain't paying. Instead of making a real and sincere mea culpa, well, they're not going to, because it's the politicians in the country that run them into the ground. But then what happens when Brussels, the warden of Europe, wow, calls on Germany for a European responsibility? Total indifference. On March 13, the European Commission did publish a report on the economic situation and indicated that Spain, Italy, and Portugal were the most fragile countries in the terrible lack of growth in the Eurozone. The report specifically singles out Germany, echoing what already the IMF and the OECD and the G20 have been stating. Germany don't play fair. Berlin has completely ignored their call for increasing expenditures in infrastructures as a way of a stimulus using its huge super vat. Wow. Germany has taken tiny steps in the last decade on all the EU recommendations. It did not increase its budget in education, in research and development, nor did it improve the fiscal system. Brussels have been asking to increase the retirement age at no avail. Of course the old people don't want to retire. They don't want to get later, older and older. They're dead before they collect a dime, man. It is recommended to revise the fiscal treatments of the so-called mini-jobs and to eliminate barriers in the service sector. Without any reaction, it asks to increase salaries, to redistribute the state super vat. In total indifference, Germany ain't going to give you no money. The commission now says clearly that the large commercial super vat makes of Germany a risk for the euro. Well, that's good. I knew that euro was a piece of shit shortly after they put it together. Early on, I thought it'd be a good idea, but no. Brussels considers that Germany is not doing anything in the matter of reforms that must increase its public investments, and concludes that its enormous budgetary asynchrony with the rest of Europe has adverse implications for the Eurozone. Now, the next thing to do is kick all the American forces out of Europe. Yeah, get all the U.S. military people out of Europe. Let us not forget the alternative for Germany was created by a group of academics who were against the euro. Oh, they were misplaced by the present leadership who wants to get rid of the Brussels interference in the life of Germans and go back to the times of a strong Germany of the past. Sieg Heil! No, wait a minute. Get down, arm. Is the path of Merkel's splendid solitude helping or weakening the European dream? No doubt she is a brilliant national leader, but a European one? She's a brilliant national leader. I think her treasury secretary may be. But anyhow, we don't know why she's doing what she's doing. We don't know who's controlling the strings, but chaos is wonderful. It's like a pretty good source of information. You can go to ipsnews.net, European News Service, ipsnews.net.
Yes, honey? It happened on one of them zippity-doo-dah days. Now, that's the kind of day when you can't open your mouth without a song jump right out of it. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-ay. My, oh, my, what a wonderful day. Plenty of sunshine heading my way. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-ay. Mr. Bluebird's on my shoulder.
It's the truth. It's actual.
Everything is satisfactual. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-a. Wonderful feeling, wonderful day. Yes, sir. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-a. My, oh, my, what a wonderful day.
Oh, plenty of sunshine in the wind.
Mr. Bluebird's on my shoulder. It's the truth, mm-hmm. It's actual. Everything is satisfactory. Zippity-doo-dah, zippity-a. Wonderful feeling, feeling this way.
Odin, bless chaos.